Hi, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific, your dose of maritime security analysis with a side of think tank thug life. As always, I'm your host, Natalie Sambi, and today we'll be bringing you a special joint podcast with the Perth US Asia Centre. I chat with my colleague Kyle Springer and Reid Foster, a retired Army officer and defence capabilities analyst at IHS Janes. We'll be talking about Australia's newly released 2016 Defence White Paper. What are the highlights and what does it tell us about how Australia's thinking about the strategic landscape? But before we get into that and half a bottle of Beaumont, we'll be back after this short break. Take it away, Martha.
SIMSAC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSAC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSAC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for the leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSAC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Welcome back to the Perth US Asia Center Perspectives Podcast, where we give you a break from the ubiquitous screen and talk about the developments shaping international affairs in the Indo-Pacific region. I'm your host, Kyle Springer. This week, we're sitting down with Perth US Asia Center Research Fellow Natalie Sambi and Reid Foster, an analyst with IHS Janes and a defense capabilities expert, to discuss last week's release of Australia's defense white paper. The white paper lays out Australia's defense posture for the next several years, including goals for defense spending and expanding the number of Australian Defence Force personnel. The white paper revealed the Australian government wants to procure 12 submarines to be built at a cost of more than 50 billion Australian dollars. Natalie, Reid, and I are sitting down in our studio to enjoy a couple sips of Beaumont and a conversation about the defense white paper. Thank you, Reid and Natalie, for joining us today. Before we unpack the content of Australia's new defense white paper, I want to ask you both about your background, what you're doing now, and how you got into defense analysis. And finally, how does Perth fit into the picture?
Certainly. Background is primarily from a military background. Spent some time as a U.S. Army officer back in the mid-2000s. And then went to London for a graduate degree in war studies. Directly from there, was picked up by Janes, which is an intelligence and defense firm. And I've been working for Janes for about 8 years now. Now, that was primarily in London until about 6 months ago when I relocated down here to Perth and have been sort of inculcating myself into the defense security community here while continuing to cover Oceania and the Middle Eastern region.
Thank you, Reid. And Natalie?
Hello. Well, I started off in Perth and then I moved to Canberra, where I joined the Department of Defence's Graduate Development Program. And I was there for a short while and then did some freelance work and returned to Canberra to work for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, where I was an Indonesia analyst for 3.5 years and managing editor of The Strategist. So in that time, I got across as many of Australia's major defence and strategic issues and have been continuing to work on the Indonesian military since then as well.
And now you've joined us here in Perth.
Yeah, I'm here, back in Perth.
And it's good to have you back, Natalie. Let's turn to the big news story of last week. Australia's new defense white paper was released, which articulates the country's strategic outlook for the next 20 years, as well as outlining major capability platforms for the Australian Defence Force. Looking at the broad contours of the document, the defense white paper makes innumerable references to the Indo-Pacific as Australia's strategic neighborhood. This isn't new. The term Indo-Pacific was used in past white papers, but is Australia right to define its strategic interests regionally rather than globally?
Well, I think, Australia finds itself basically straddling two worlds here. I mean, the Indo-Pacific is obviously its backyard, so to speak. A lot of the alliances it's looking to firm up are within the Indo-Pacific region. However, to keep strong alliances with countries like the United States and the UK, they do still find themselves drawn into more globalized contexts, most recently, obviously, in the Middle East, battling IS. So I think as much as Australia would like to focus on its own backyard, it will continually to be pulled because of its composition, disposition, and global outlook, and seeking to align itself with like-minded actors such as the U.S. and being an active supporter, which it has been very much so, especially in the fight against IS. So I think that there is a definite push to try to ensure that Indo-Pacific comes first, but there will continue to be situations and security requirements that will necessitate Australia participation in order to ensure that it promotes its own values as well as supports those of its allies.
I think we're getting known a little bit as an expeditionary force, other than doing things in our own backyard. But I think Reid's right. We have this focus on the Indo-Pacific, but we end up joining coalitions to do important work overseas. It's essential, I think, that Australia plays a key role in the fight against Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And he has its eye in that theater. But inevitably, the strategic weight is going to center in the Indo-Pacific, particularly around Southeast Asia, and given some of China's recent behavior, inevitably we're going to have to respond to that. And inevitably, the stability of our near abroad is going to be one of our strategic interests. So we are going to have to prepare for those kinds of contingencies. The Indo-Pacific, I think, is the right construct, given the growth of the region and the importance of those trade routes. And actually, I just wanted to bring up something that came up in the podcast I did with Jashana the other day. It's interesting that India is a little bit more pussyfooted about using the term Indo-Pacific, but we've seemed to have run with it. We're a lot more comfortable, I think, by virtue of geography, positioning ourselves and calling this region our operating area as opposed to India, which is a little bit more reluctant. So I think for us, it makes perfect sense. For other countries, a little bit more reluctance depending on the level of responsibility they want to take on. So, yeah, looking out to 2035, as the defense white paper does, makes perfect sense.
Yes, indeed. The white paper's strategic outlook predicts countries in the Indo-Pacific region will continue to modernize their militaries and grow their capabilities. It also predicts half the world's submarines will be operating in the Indo-Pacific in the next two decades. Historically, do arms races inevitably lead to conflict?
I don't know that we can draw a lot of parallels between, modernization programs or expansion of military capabilities and the inevitability of conflict, so to speak. I mean, I think, this is a reaction and maybe not an unforeseen reaction to China's growth. I think you'll see a lot of militaries locally or within the Indo-Pacific region adjusting their defense outlook and adjusting their procurement strategies based off of what they're seeing grow from China. And I don't think Australia is any different in that regard. I think this would have been a very different defense white paper, of course, if China had not grown exponentially within the last two decades. But at face value, it's always a bit of a push-pull with defense. And Australia is not the only country that is responding this way. We've seen Japan obviously go through quite a few changes, both constitutionally and with its defense forces, in response to what it sees as a change of the status quo. I don't know that an arms race, or so to speak, is what's going on, but there is a natural adjustment with the ebbs and flows of the geopolitical situation. But more often than not, this equipment is never used to its purpose, thankfully. A lot of the growth, especially in the naval realm, obviously makes sense with the, you know, the critical nature of maritime and maritime trade in the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, for sure. I would definitely agree that, some of it is in response to the shifts in the strategic region. Oh, there we go. This is talking about the importance. Bringing attention to that.
You're just getting edited out right now.
Brilliant. No. We'll see how we go.
We'll see how we go. This is our cutting-edge studio.
So talking about military modernization, I'm just going to shift it a little bit south from what Reed was talking about in terms of, Japan. Certainly, it's not just a response to China's behavior and looking at securing the maritime realm. Southeast Asian countries will argue, we've got more cash, we can buy more stuff, it's due, our stuff is old, and for whatever reason, countries like Indonesia that had the arms embargo is looking to modernize its force. But of course, some part of that has to be in response to the strategic environment. So I think that argument is compelling to a degree. And then you kind of have to say, well, you know, you might be modernizing, but what's the composition of your force structure then? What are you responding to? So I think most certainly, you know, the growth in GDP in these countries has certainly allowed for that force modernization, but some of the strategic impetus has certainly been the behavior of certain actors. Interestingly, also like arms flows within the Indo-Pacific region, the number of deals that seemingly will be done with India, different capability transfers between Japan and the Philippines, for instance, I think are also an interesting part of that modernization story as well.
And I have to add on to that, you know, it doesn't actually mean that, you know, if they're procuring it, it's actually something they need. I mean, there's a lot of...
Could be vanity projects.
Yeah, there could be vanity projects. Or unsuitable. I mean, you know, a lot of submarines are actually perhaps not the best platform to go with in the shallow sort of, especially Southeast Asia. You know, these things have to be modified from their original format just to be able to operate in shallow and warmer waters. And arguably, you know, for a country that has most of the littoral EEZs and whatnot that is supposed to patrol, you know, do you need a quite capable kilo-class submarine to patrol your waters?
Of course you do. Yeah. Of course you do.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. It's like, okay, you've got the boat. What about the people? Do you have an adequate force of trained people that can operate in the submarines? If you're thinking about a nuclear force, do you have capable scientists and a civilian nuclear, you know, capability plus education system that's going to retain this kind of talent? Yes or no, maybe?
Never stopped countries in the past.
I mean, oh, no.
we can look through the Middle East to several actors there that, let's say, you know, their acquisition aspirations and their ability to employ that equipment to its full effect are maybe out of step, you know. And there is a risk, I think, of procuring first and then trying to backfill, you know, an actual capability. It's one thing to own the equipment, but to actually employ it to its full purpose, I think it requires actually a little bit more strategic planning than just putting a boat in the water and saying, look, we've got, you know, six submarines now. You know, we can protect whatever we want to protect. Quite a bit more. I think we'll find that, you know, there might be some growing pains, especially
sure.
with, you know, Southeast Asian countries that, you know, are you know, acquiring some fairly advanced defense equipment that, you know, was supposedly designed to counter, you know, in the Cold War, you know, force on force, and we're now dealing with a different security environment with very similar platforms. So, but we'll see. I don't think that, it'll automatically translate to a massive step change in their capability despite their possession of this equipment, you know. So, you know, yet to be seen.
Yeah, watch this space.
Yeah.
We'll definitely be coming back to submarines, but first, the defense white paper admits that a direct attack on Australia is a remote possibility and outlines other emerging unconventional threats like cybersecurity and terrorism. If so, then why the focus on expanding Australia's conventional military kit, like its next generation of submarines, surveillance aircraft, and so on?
Well, I think a lot of this is actually following and ensuring that Australia stays on a leading edge of defense developments. I mean, a lot of the acquisitions we're seeing are either one-for-one replacements, so they're not massive expansion, you're not doubling the size of the fleet. You're retiring older kit and replacing it with, you know, kit that has been evolving over the last decade or so, and ensuring that you're more or less have some parity. If you're going to deploy this equipment, you want to make sure that it's one of the, you know, most significant and representative combat outliers for, you know, deployment. But You know, I think what we're seeing is as you said, it's not a lot of, internal defense. This is all long leg type of equipment. This is all force projection outside of Australia's, borders and sustainment of that force, wherever it may be. But, I don't know that will change anytime soon. I don't think there are any actors within the region that will threaten Australia as its territorial integrity. And I think the white paper is obviously an admission of this, and the fact that you are basically building an expeditionary force, by all intents and purposes, with the ability to, patrol longer, farther, and for longer durations, does say something about where Australia sees itself in the next 20 years.
I mean, I think defense is partly an insurance policy, right? And we're looking out to 2035. What's the world possibly going to look like? And if you were caught short without anything to accommodate any of those contingencies, then obviously our government would be remiss in not providing, the most valuable kind of security for the defense of Australia. So inevitably, some of the big ticket items tend to be those parts of the defense white paper that we all hone in on: 12 submarines, the Poseidons, air warfare destroyers, so on and so forth. But the language of the defense white paper, as Reid said, there are lots of other component parts that are important, talking about enablers, about logistics, about cultural change, and also dual use capability. So I think some of that gets buried a little bit, but it's so important for the way in which we deploy our Australian Defence Force, not just in high-end war fighting, which, as we emphasise, is a low probability outcome, but for all of those other contingencies within the immediate or near region or other humanitarian...
Things like disaster.
Absolutely.
Relief,
humanitarian assistance, yeah. Disaster relief,
okay.
Other kinds of contingencies like that. And certainly for exercises. Yeah, so there are other components, I would say. Go and for a few people to read the white paper and get a sense of what those additional developments and changes that the government is going to reinforce between now and 2035.
I think a lot of these capabilities are built to ensure that Australia stays a leader in the region. A lot of this equipment ensures better communication, more situational awareness, and the ability to, work and partner with some of these Southeast Asian allies, to ensure that, those capabilities are maintained or enhanced in those specific regards. But that's something where it can very easily break down, something like cross-communication or interaction, especially in a big disaster. It's very important to make sure that your infrastructure to do that is already established prior to an event occurring, But the same systems and practices that work in a combat environment obviously work very, very well in a high-intensity situation like a post-hurricane or typhoon situation. So, I think the dual-use aspect is important and obviously something that, the defense establishment, but the political establishment wants to promote as well, as far as being like, this isn't just to, engage and defeat our enemies. This is also to ensure that, we are in a place that we can be a substantive actor in all range of scenarios in Southeast Asia or the Indo-Pacific region.
Are there conventional threats to Australian security? Natalie, it's on.
Finger gets pointed to me.
To you.
Well, I think the thing I'm going to think first and foremost is most people are is what's going to go down in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
So I think the last week, what was the... can't remember which atoll or artificial island was it, that there appears to be structures.
Woody Island? No, that's where they deployed
air defense assets.
Yeah so there okay. There was the recent recognition that there was a slight militarization of some of these areas that China is taking control of in the South China Sea. And the question is, to what extent does that ramp up tension, and to what extent does that sort of set that particular context up for a confrontation potentially with another Southeast Asian country? And if that happens, we've got to assess the likelihood of that breaking out into some sort of high-end warfare. And if that does happen, then I think that might be more... that will assume the character of a more conventional threat. Other than that, I think most of the threats that Australia is seeing, maybe non-traditional, but certainly things like terrorism, both offshore and domestically to a lesser extent, plus the humanitarian... contingencies that we talked about before, state fragility in the region. Those are the things that we should also be thinking about, climate change. But I think, it's a lesser probability, but it exists, that threat of conventional, that traditional conventional threat.
I would agree. I mean, I think that I don't think that the white paper set out to recognize or to emphasize any sort of conventional threat that Australia is you know, probably going to confront in the near term. I think there is a worry about, you know, if something like freedom of navigation patrols go forward, ensuring that, you know, that doesn't create a situation where you have a, you know, force-on-force engagement, if possible. But, you know, I think that Australia recognizes that it needs to be prepared for such a thing. If it's going to go to the links of, you know, actually going through a freedom of navigation patrol, that it doesn't get caught with its proverbial pants around its ankles if something were to develop. I mean, that's part of the reasoning for putting your most advanced kit forward into these situations. You have the widest range of options should something develop. So I think in the near term, any conventional threat remains remote, but not altogether diminished.
I have a simple scenario. Mm-hmm. Say North Korea were to develop missile technology that put major Australian cities within range.
I often think simple when I hear that.
you know, what does this change? How does this change Australia's security calculus? Does it? What are your thoughts?
I think, you know, I mean, you could argue that there might be a shift to try to prioritize a missile defense system that could potentially intercept something or set into place, not dissimilar to Japan, agreements with the U.S. to have Aegis destroyers, you know, in the vicinity. I don't know that Australia would take a more robust stance as far as advocating strikes against North Korea or anything like that. I think they would follow in a similar pattern to both Japan and South Korea, who are obviously the most significant threat, and the U.S. to that degree with their military presence in the area, in that, you know, trying to find a path forward to allow North Korea to, or convince North Korea to abandoning its developments in that arena. I'm not sure. I don't think Australia would be too reactionary, though, if that were the case. I think it would recognize that, you know, it's not the only country that's under threat, and, you know, working with partners to ensure that that threat is mitigated is probably going to be the best way forward for them.
Yeah, I think there are a range of options and a range of responses. If we're just looking in terms of defense white paper infrastructure, setting aside diplomacy and the deployment of basketball players and things like that, yeah, I would agree with Reid. I don't know whether or not developing a sophisticated indigenous missile defense system is the way to go. I think we would leverage off our partners and allies and come to some sort of arrangement for that first and foremost, and regional arrangements with other major players if we could see, you know, engaging China in this, for instance. You know, I think recently there have been sanctions that have been applied against North Korea as well, and China is starting to play a bigger role in that. And one would have to ask, well, to what degree, what role could China play in mitigating this kind of threat, if interested, if whatever conditions there existed at that point. But I think that's certainly something that we ought to think about. But yeah, other than waiting and seeing to North Korea, you know, does your capability actually work? How credible is it? Those are other questions to ask. And how hungry is Kim Jong-un on that day? You know, has he got some other stuff in his mind? We've just had a top-up, and now we're going into part two of our podcast.
So, should the white paper have included soft power strategies to enhance Australia's security, things like foreign aid, etc., or is that a separate white paper? What do you guys think?
I think typically defense white paper does obviously focus on the defense-oriented factors. I think that there are other mouthpieces for government that obviously promote more soft power. And I think to do so in the defense white paper would maybe distracting from, you know, the primary purpose of what the defense white paper is supposed to do, which is supposed to provide a very clear and thought-out strategic direction and couch that to budgetary requirements, to capability requirements. So I'm not surprised that we don't see more soft power in the defense white paper, although it's certainly part of the government arsenal when it comes to, you know, full engagement of local and international partners.
Yeah, look, the defense white paper is primarily about the use of the military as a tool of government. And so each department, and this is primarily led by Department of Defense, is going to have their different lens in viewing how the government can wield its influence and its tools. So yes, it makes perfect sense that this is primarily focused on the use of high power, But, of course, within that inherent is the discussion of defense diplomacy and the boosting. I mean, the white paper talks about boosting international engagement, talking about boosting of presence of military personnel, increased exercises, which can fall under the soft engagement side of things. But at the end of the day, we're using, you know, assets, boats, personnel that come from that hard power tradition in this kind of way. So, yeah, totally agree with Reed. I think our aid program should have its own sort of strategic vision about where it should head and how that dovetails in with foreign policy. The white paper does make reference to the kind of permissive environments in fragile states and ungoverned states, which would give rise to considerations of other tools of government, like aid money and or, you know, other kinds of heavy invested diplomacy. But insofar as the defense white paper is concerned, it does what it needs to do.
Back to submarines.
Back to submarines.
Hey. Submarines will be the largest defense procurement program in Australia's history. Who do you think will build them? Will they be built in Australia?
Oh.
I mean, Japan's proposed, I think, at least a partial build in Australia, or
I believe they've committed to almost a full build now.
Full build, okay.
Yeah. Wow. And I think actually you can say that maybe the competitive evaluation actually did what it was supposed to do, in that it push some of these companies to maybe give more ground in an effort to try to win these bids. And I think Australia was the benefactor from it. The competitive evaluation process also brought the total cost of the boats down, which allowed for the 12-boat build to be planned for, rather than the 9-boat build, which was mooted a couple years ago. So I think, you know, it's a hot topic of consideration. Many would argue that the Japanese have the advantage, and the government has, you know, softly committed to the Japanese, and this competitive evaluation process is very little more than window dressing. I think it's probably a little bit more than that. I mean, obviously, with decisions this large, the government itself needs to ensure that it doesn't end up in a scenario where, if something were to go wrong, you can look back and say, you know, they didn't bother to shop around a bit to ensure that, you know, Australians are getting the best value for money, and they have the best technical equipment to suit their capability requirements. So I think it does serve a lot of purposes. I think Australia probably benefits from this. All that being said, you know, my personal opinion is that from a technical standpoint, the Japanese likely have the closest to the Australian requirements as far as range, durability, and some of the detection or counter-detection capabilities that the submarines have. The French bid is probably second with the Scorpene class. The German bid, I think, is probably the least likely for several scenarios from a technical standpoint. But the Japanese also have the advantage of a strengthening of strategic interests as far as working together, having a tangible asset to work together and develop, which the Japanese are very keen to do, and I think will go to some length to ensure that you know, their bid is considered very seriously for this, because for the Japanese government, this is a real opportunity. Let's not forget that Japanese government have not had a lot of defense-to-defense relationships outside of the U.S. It sees Australia as a common partner the last decade. The partnership between Japan and Australia from a strategic concept has been strengthened, and this might just be the next step along that path. You know, it's not a mutual dependency relationship, but I think it may well be a mutually beneficial arrangement that will allow them a tangible foot in Australia to be able to work together, you know, to advance their common interests there.
That's an interesting point, actually. Let's set aside, for instance, for the moment, that the Japan's bid might be better aligned to what our requirements are, and just take a look at the strategic partnership that you talked about just now. And this is how I see it, an opportunity. Mm-hmm. My question is that if Japan is really pursuing this in order to maximize its relationships with other strategic partners in the region because of the circumstances we find ourselves in, is it really the case that the submarine bid for Australia is the best opportunity to do that? And so if at the end of the day, are we going to be the benefactors of that? Or should we be considering other ways in which we build this relationship with Japan? In other words, what I'm saying, what should be driving Australia is not only this desire to build better strategic relations with Japan. The question is, would that happen anyway if we did not go with Japan? That's the other question. Like, what investment would it take for us to achieve the same kind of close strategic relationship, interoperability, you know, an understanding between our countries and our militaries that would not involve potentially compromising our submarine capability? So set that aside. And then now taking into account submarine capability, I think it's definitely drawn forth a more competitive process between the three players. I think when Abbott was still in power, people saw this as a thinly veiled attempt at just making something look like it was a transparent process to go through and to account for taxpayers' money, which is a substantial amount, I should point out. And no doubt there was a close relationship there and a desire to draw closer between Abe and Abbott. The German government seems to be a little bit more circumspect with declaring what their interests are and just going with the process, which is great. French bid obviously looks more competitive. But I would still like to explore what other opportunities are there for not only our close relationship with Japan, but also encouraging other partners like India. I think Harry B. Harris recently said, SPACOM commander, at the Raisina dialogue, that he was interested in more quadrilateral cooperation. So again, I mean, if we've got these additional opportunities, interfaces, exercises, activities that we can engage in with Japan, maybe not bilaterally, but multilaterally, does that make up for our desire to become closer or quasi-alliance partners? So I'll just add that much.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that you brought up. And I would argue that I think the strategic direction that both Australia and Japan find itself on, I don't think this will be derailed if Japan is not the preferred bidder at the end of this process. I think you will see more interoperability. You will see capabilities align themselves. I think, you know, there is a mutual understanding between Japan and Australia that, you know, they have very similar outlooks on where they would like, you know, the Asia-Pacific region to be in the next, you know, 20, 40 years. So, you know, I think regardless, I think that sub-bid is actually an opportunity that Japan and Australia, you know, would benefit from, but I don't think it's the linchpin. I don't think this alliance will fall apart. It's not actually a reliance, but, you know, this alignment will fall apart if this bid does not get to go Japan's way. And I think, you know, I don't think Australia is buying subs just because it thinks, well, this will be an easy way for us to, you know, convene our common interests. There is a requirement for the submarines, you know, according to the government. You know, it says, okay, we choose to move forward with these submarines. And I think, you know, any sort of byproduct from that process, you know, is potentially beneficial. But at the end of the day, you know, the defense establishment has established, okay, to meet the government's requirements for security, this is what we require to do that. And at the end of the day, whatever shakes out of that, obviously, industry wants to benefit from that. Obviously, you know, alliances can benefit from that. But it's Australia's choice what it sees its own requirements as.
Looking forward, what are some emerging threats that could change Australia's defense strategy?
Well, I think, you know, these things are always very difficult to predict. You know, you can't point to one white paper and say, well, they got it right 100%. You know, they were able to foresee what was going to happen and they responded appropriately, you know, with their foresight. But I think, you know, there are some assumptions that go on here, as there always have to be. A lot of times, you know, these papers are, you know, several years in the making sometime, you know, 18, 24 months. And priorities can shift even in that period of time. When this particular defense white paper began, Islamic State was not on the radar as far as being an entity that, you know, the Australian defense establishment would have to respond against. So there will be aspects of that. I think it's the degree by which Australia will choose to be involved or not. I think, you know, what was omitted from this is that the security environment in Southeast Asia, even setting aside China and China's, you know, ambitions, remains the same. Any sort of civil conflicts or anything that would destabilize some of the region, humanitarian issues that might come about from, you know, let's say a split, you know, not perhaps as significant as what happened in Syria among sectarian lines, but I think, you know, that's not something that obviously is right in the cards in the immediate term, but that would probably change how Australia positions itself, how it deploys its forces, because it is very, very, it wants to be very invested in Southeast Asia. So if you had a situation like that developed in Southeast Asia, I think Australia would want to take a leading role in trying to, you know, mitigate whatever consequences, you know, that particular conflict might have. So, but there again, these are all occurring, you know, within Australia's periphery, and, you know, some of the procurement priorities as far as being able to sustain Australian forces abroad for longer periods of time all add to their flexibility and able to encounter these unforeseen threats and these unforeseen conflicts that might arise. And and flexibility is, I think, what they're trying to emphasize in here. You can call it expeditionary capability. You can call it, you know, sort of force projection. But at the end of the day, you know, Australia looks to be able to encounter as much as they can along this spectrum of, you know, conflict as possible.
So in 2014, the Defense White Paper panel, or what did they call it?
It was consultation groups.
Consultation groups, yeah. Consultation groups. They came to Perth, and we hosted them here. The center hosted them.
Yeah.
And this was 2014, June or July.
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah. So already, you know, the feedback that they received is a couple years old. So I'm sure they've taken steps to update it. But
I mean, you know, let's say, you know, obviously Islamic State didn't factor in at that point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think that something like Islamic State has actually altered the trajectory of, you know, the Australian defense establishment or its strategic mm-hmm. priorities. You know, it's because it is inherently a bit flexible, it's able to deploy, you know, F-18s to conduct strikes. It's able to deploy the wedge-tails to support. It's able to deploy, you know, assets, you know, to support a coalition effort without pulling the entire establishment in one direction or the other. And I think it's that level of flexibility they're going to look forward to ensuring they're able to work with in the future.
Natalie, what do you think?
This is really interesting, actually, listening to Reid. I mean, I completely agree with everything that Reid said. But what sprang to mind is really the importance of understanding our region. And, you know, I couldn't help but think of the Asian Century White Paper, now defunct, for a number of reasons. But certainly when Reid was talking about understanding the kinds of internal dynamics that are occurring within not only Southeast Asia, but within the South Pacific, and even within the Middle East theater as well, North Africa, so on and so forth, brings home to me the importance of having Australian subject matter experts who have a granular understanding, actually I really hate that word, a really deep understanding of what's occurring between the various forces, and I mean like political, religious, other kinds of forces within each country, and then feeding that back into not only government, but the defense establishment to building a really comprehensive picture of what the operating environment may look like 2020, 2025, 2030, so on and so forth. Because I think then that gives us much more fidelity when we come to draft the strategic outlook. And hopefully, like Reid said, we're never going to get it right. But where we have a comparative advantage, say, relative to other countries in the world of getting this region and projecting an understanding, I think we're in a really good spot for that. And I would like to see more of that. And it's a sidebar, you know, like just if we had to sort of say, what would you wish for in a defense white paper? Maybe a supplementary document about how we actually build some of our understanding about these regions or what we're looking for, or maybe something that's you know, I don't know how defense recruits in future for this kinds of stuff, but that would be really interesting. And no doubt our intel agencies play a role into shaping that understanding, but it's just something that's brought home by Reid's point.
Yeah, if they were able to incorporate a more comprehensive understanding, they would be doing very much more than many other militaries. Even the most advanced militaries in the world get this wrong very, very often because, mm-hmm. You know, the defense establishment has a tendency to view its role in a very narrow sense. You know, as long as it has the capability and the kit to do mission X, Y, and Z, you know, it stops there. But sometimes you paint yourself into a corner with that you know engagement. You can be very, very good at that specific range of tasks, but very seldom, you know, do your actual missions only, you know, fall within this very narrow corridor of responsibility. And I think, you know, it would show, you know, an actual very mature way to approach, you know, defense by incorporating a lot of these elements of you know, and admitting when you probably got some blind spots, you know, and I would say that Australia is no different than many other countries, and there are a lot of blind spots when it actually comes to, you know, the regions they might actually be involved in, and the regions they want to promote, you know, good relations with and promote, you know, strategic things. It's very easy to get club some guys together from Indonesia and Singapore and Australia and run an air exercise where you're, you know, bombing targets and that sort of stuff. That, you know, we've done that for, you know, decades and decades and decades. Mm-hmm. To actually sit down and appreciate, you know, what the knock-on effects of military engagement might be, and how to actually utilize force in a way that is most effective, I think, you know, would take it to a different plane. And I think Australia is actually probably in a fairly good position to play that role, especially regionally. So, you know, personally, I'd like to see something like that develop.
I'm going to get my nerd on for a second and actually, like, delve into the text of the white paper, page 119, for all you keen people out there. paragraph 5.10 says the government will increase the number of defense personnel overseas to conduct more liaison, blah, blah, blah. And this is the point I'm interested in. We will also seek to increase the number of liaison personnel from other countries in Australia in areas such as strategic policy development, intel analysis, and operational coordination. Like, no doubt we've got embeds from the Pentagon and at Russell offices in Canberra. I would be really interested to see whether there's potential there to increase the number of liaison personnel from countries in the region. I think that would be very interesting in terms of input, not only for the knowledge that those liaison personnel would bring back to their own country in terms of white paper drafting, I'm looking at you, Indonesia, but also about procurement processes, but also just an injection of their understanding of what their Defense Department looks like, feels like, works like, all of that kind of stuff. That would be a really simple way of getting that firsthand knowledge, and a really creative way, I think, of doing that too. So,
And I think if there is a way to capture that knowledge and then let it proliferate throughout the organization, because too often you'll have praise like this that will make some great strides, but it's limited to a very small number of people that, you know, either have physical conversations or whatnot, and then you have a potential to lose that knowledge. So it's not only capturing or enabling it to happen, it's also allowing it to proliferate across, you know, the organization, the defense establishment in this case.
I think that's true. And making sure that these kinds of programs endure, that they don't go through one iteration and then die, like making sure there's that kind of, institutional support for that. And that there's a culture of encouraging these kinds of interactions. That would be great. And a rap battle, of course.
And hopefully think tanks like the Perth US Asia Center, we can kind of support.
Yeah, absolutely.
These kind of efforts. Mm-hmm. But wrapping up, what are your top three takeaways from the defense white paper? What should people know about?
Let me see what I've written down in my notes here. I think what I feel has changed in the last couple of years. I feel like this is a pretty comprehensive white paper. And what I mean by that is it not only just talks about the obvious contingencies, you know, Meg talks about space, talks about Antarctica, talks about climate change, talks about cultural change within the Australian Defence Organisation. And those are really interesting things because it's cognizant of the way that which not only we respond to the environment, but how we ourselves are evolving. I read my former colleague Rod Lyon wrote an interesting post on The Strategist, about how the theme of uncertainty was much more prevalent through this paper. And I think that's a very mature way of approaching the strategic outlook and just admitting that there's a lot that we're going to respond to, and the way in which we position ourselves and the way in which we kind of plan our force structure has got to be flexible. I think I appreciated that about this paper as well. Once I read Rod's post, I was able to see that come through as well. So that's two. Maybe Reed can start his three, and I can move another.
Sure. No, I'll just dovetail a little bit off of what Natalie brought up there. I think they took their time with this white paper, and I think it shows. I don't think you see a lot of the reactionary sort of very, very, you know, comprehensive but vague statements about how actually they're going to go about, you know, what is the purpose and how are they going to, you know, fund this equipment, number one, especially in an economic climate that's getting a bit softer, you know. And I think they wanted to ensure that, you know, this had the feel of, you know, we've taken this, we've chewed it over, we've stopped, we've taken a breath, we've chewed it over again, and this is where we think we need to be. And I think in defense acquisition, obviously, all of these wheels need to be set in motion sometimes, you know, decades in advance of, you know, the programs actually coming online or reaching full operational capability. And I think for programs such as the submarine program or the F-35 programs, you need to ensure that, you know, your basis for acquisition, your reasoning for why you're getting this equipment is grounded in reality and not just because you think you should or, you know, your perception of who you should be. And I think it did strike a good tone with that. The second point, I think, is a reiteration of the fact that, you know, Australia finds itself in a position where, you know, it has to embrace, you know, the flexibility. And to do that, its force projection capabilities have to be able to support the type of missions that Australia sees for itself in the future. And this requires, you know, not a vast amount of equipment, but the type of equipment that you need has to be fairly advanced in what it can do and the amount of scenarios that you can it can perform. And we're not seeing, you know, conventional tank and artillery in, you know, in its hundreds being procured here. We are seeing some select few but highly advanced capable equipment, and equipment that has proven itself as far as useful in the defense establishment is being committed to upgrade instead of just, you know, a wanton replacement. So that's the second point. Third point is, I think, you know, Australia's defense establishment is very interested in creating a force where the tri-services can work together almost seamlessly. I think they want to reduce any sort of redundancies or replication of mission. And I think, you know, there is a push to break down institutional barriers when it comes to, okay, well, this is the Army or the Air Force or the Navy. Australian Defense Force is not massive, and it needs to be able to work together really, really well. And I think not only the emphasis on partnering with regional allies, but conducting joint exercises as well, I think you'll see an uptick in that to ensure that you're getting all the efficiencies out of having this very flexible equipment. You know, things like amphibious exercises that require air, land, and sea assets will probably be, you know, moved to the fore. So I guess that's my main three. I'm going to circle back to Natalie.
No worries. Actually, that's an interesting point Reed brought up about creating a joint environment. Just a small anecdote from my time in defense. When General David Hurley was VCDF at the time, he used to use a purple pen. And that was his way, because joint fell under the VCDF portfolio, his way of signifying that he was joint, that he was not of any service, that he was there for the integrated force, which is interesting. I think each of the services will have their different distinct cultures. But yeah, I think for the most part, the Australian military does quite well in terms of working together, the three services, that is. Now, I kind of finished up with maybe like 3.5 points. So Kyle, I'm going to beg your forgiveness and just deal with that.
No worries.
One other thing that obviously came up in the white paper for me was a heavy emphasis on maritime. That was interesting, and I think that's a fair reflection of the importance of the maritime environment, not only to Australia, but to a lot of the key actors within the Indo-Pacific region as well, and what they're focused on. And I don't see that going away anytime between now and 2035. And then honing in a little bit more specifically on Indonesia. Anecdotally, I know that the language about Indonesia is increasingly optimistic if you go through from 2009, 2013, now in 2016, my goodness, where's time gone, that the language about Indonesia has become much more constructive, that we're no longer praising it for its success in democracy, we're just taking that as a given and now talking about its economic growth. The one thing I would like to add, which I'll expand elsewhere, is that while we talk about Indonesia becoming more influential, I think for you and I as Indonesianists, our understanding is not that that's not the way Indonesia sees itself as becoming more influential. It's going back to being more influential. And I think that nuance is important when you're trying to understand, again, where regional states are coming from. And you know, the Defense White Paper is not going to do everything. But I think adding a bit of context there, it's an interesting, I think, way of differentiating the way Australia sees Indonesia and the way Indonesia sees itself. But that is a topic for another day.
For another podcast.
Another podcast and another bottle.
Thank you, Natalie. My last question is very pertinent to international affairs in the Indo-Pacific, particularly Perth's soft power. Oh. Where are your favorite places to have coffee in Perth? Reed, your
Architects and Heroes is coming in number one.
Okay. Architects and Heroes, where is that?
It's off of Rockaby.
That's in Subiaco.
That is in Subiaco. Yeah, and fantastic mural, by the way, in the back. Check that out. If I need to pick me up... they're my folks. Four shots in a long Mac is they'll turn around any day for me.
You're talking about a quadruple espresso?
Yeah, I call it a quad.
Damn.
A quad.
The other quad.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, having just returned to Perth, a lot of my favorite coffee shops have shifted.
You had trouble even just finding Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah. Australia, lift your game. So I have to say, just having coming back from DC with their proliferation of free Wi-Fi everywhere, which was amazing. Busboys and Poets, love your work. So far back in Perth, I found that Mary Street Bakery in Mount Lawley.
Mm. Yeah.
Really like the vibe. Mm. Minimalistic architecture on the inside. Good service. Just kind of really nice and earthy. The food around me looked really good. Their soy chai, definitely all for it. But definitely a good working environment if you want to take a notebook and have a ponder about all things fascinating like the Defense White Paper 2016.
What about yourself, moderator? What do you
prefer? Oh, yeah.
So I'm still honing my tastes on coffee, but I'm still a sucker for ambiance. So Bukla just has this eclectic, nice... Even if the coffee was bad, just the environment around you would make it taste better. So,
yeah, and that's Bukla where?
That's Bukla. That's on Rokeby Road in Subiaco
as well. Okay.
Wow.
Two Subies and a Mount Lawley.
Yeah.
Old Perth.
Yeah. Good.
Excellent.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us for a discussion on the Defense White Paper 2016. And thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to be here at Perth US Asia Center. And hopefully be around for another event soon.
Thanks very much, Carl. To all our Perth listeners, wishing you a happy long weekend, and we'll see you on Tuesday.
That was our research fellow, Natalie Samby, an IHS Jane's analyst and former U.S. Army officer, Reed Foster, on Australia's 2016 Defense White Paper. Thank you for listening to the Perth U.S. Asia Center Perspectives podcast. Before we go, a quick shout out to our sponsors. Our foundation corporate partner is Rio Tinto, and also a thanks to UWA, U.S. Studies Center in Sydney, and the state and federal governments. I'm off to enjoy my long weekend. We'll see you next time.